Without further ado, first of all, let me thank you all for coming. Let me thank Michael and the Library Colloquia Series for co-sponsoring this specific brown bag. And let me introduce Dennis Stromat. So Dennis is well known as a historian of his area. He's also well known as an unbelievable Cajun and just regular fiddle player. And a real both capturer and interpreter and preserver and promoter of the culture of his area of Missouri and of Southern Illinois. He has degrees from the Southern Illinois University of Carbondale, also University of Quebec, and Southeast Missouri State University in Missouri. And tonight, he is at, I believe we're back at, what, the Unitarian Church, or are we at the Community Music School tonight for £10? Unitarian? Yeah. Unitarian Church over on Grove Street, right? And that's at 8 o'clock, I believe, and he'll be performing over there. But today, in our Brown Bag series, he's talking about French Creole music and language from the Missouri Mines, 1723 to 2008. So please help me welcome Dennis Stromat.
Thank you very much. Merci, c'est un grand plaisir d'être ici aujourd'hui, de vous présenter un petit brin sur la musique, la culture, mais l'histoire de notre communauté dans Sud-Illinois, mais en Sud-Est Missouri. Mais on vient avec une grande communauté française, créole, qui reste toujours dans notre campagne aujourd'hui. So, how many of y'all get that? All right, we got one. All right, so that means I need to not speak a whole lot of French today. Probably be a good idea. All right, well, I did want you to hear just a little bit of the accent that we speak. Parce que sinon, français, c'est un petit peu différent le français qui en parle en la France, par exemple. We speak a little bit different French in Illinois and Missouri than what is spoken in France or even in Quebec, slightly. Fortunately, I've had the opportunity to live amongst Creoles in our area all my life, basically. But I've also had the opportunity to live amongst the Quebecois in Quebec, as well as amongst Cajuns down in Louisiana. All of them different groups in many ways, but also very similar in a lot of ways, having a lot of the same experiences, dealing with being essentially Francophones and a very Anglo world, and especially a very Anglo continent in North America. And in fact, even where I was born and raised, which is in Albion, Illinois, itself is a very Anglo town, but surrounded by landmarks and even families that are French, who founded the area is going back to the early part of the 1700s, and this would be the community that I essentially was raised in, raised literally on the Bonpaw Creek outside of Albion, Illinois, in that area. And the Bonpaw is known as, locally, a lot of people just call it the Bonpaw, they call it the Bompas, but in French it's known as the No Good Creek, essentially. And so, like many of our place names, where I grew up, I sort of got kind of a false read on our own community. And that's been one of the things that has sort of driven me through my career, you know, as a musician, I guess, you know, as sort of an independent folklorist and historian, is really focusing on our own communities and, you know, not always kind of, I guess I had to go to other communities to realize that there were things staring me right in the face of my own community. And what a lot of times that we do is we always use the old adage, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, you know. And what I come to find out is, you know what, the grass is just as green where we are. You just have to look down and see it. Because one of the things that I did was often to leave our area and to go to places like Quebec or go to places like Louisiana, you know, knowing that these were much larger Francophone communities. And I looked at them from the standpoint of, wow, they have more than what we have, so therefore I want to go to them. You know, they're cool, we're not, you know, kind of thing. And so, but that helped me to sort of look back into my own community and realize our greater community in Southern Illinois and Southeast Missouri, just the richness of what we have. And not only that, but the history, the breadth of the history that we have and the culture in the area and real, how that really affects people at every level of the community, people from the clergy to administrators to a lot of the people working just in the community, everyone from working in textiles to working in especially the mining industry in our area, and how, regardless of the different strata that you would come from in our communities, one of the things that I've found is that in the French communities, there has so always been sort of a cultural vein that has run through the communities that has kept people together. No matter how rich or poor you are, there have been certain cultural identifying markers, you might say, that have kept people together, and really, no matter where your place is in the community, but that you are a part, really, of an identified community. And I'll talk about some of those things when we go along, but I want to just kind of quickly mention kind of how I got into this and how doing what I do growing up where I grew up is because I grew up very close to one of the larger French communities, Vincennes, Indiana, which is along the Wabash River in southwestern Indiana. And I grew up about 45 minutes from there, but that was mainly the town, the quote-unquote, the town that we went to for anything and everything. As a child, when we'd go there, I'd get boots made by shoe cobblers in Vincennes. And I know that's kind of an antiquated thing to think about, but they're still in business. They still make shoes. And because for me, my feet were oversized, and so I needed to have the boots made. And so we would go to a place in Vincennes, Indiana. And so I was always curious about the fact that all these big events like rendezvous that they would have in the area and what they would call the 12th night balls that they would have that were essentially a cultural holdover, you might say, from the past of the French in our area. And, well, I was always interested in that, but one of the things that I missed out on growing up over in our section of French Illinois, essentially, was that the people in the community in our area did not speak French. They were French, are French. In fact, you open up a phone book in Vincennes, Indiana, and you will start reading down a list of names that are essentially just as French as any, from Normandy to Brittany or even Paris, names like Cardinal, Bouillet, Aubuchon, you know, Polite, all these different names, Boudreau, even in our area. And, well, but yet no one spoke the French language. In fact, at 13, 14 years old, I went to a state historic site one time. We were over there just milling about waiting for something, and we went to one of the state historic sites, and as we would often do, they kind of came old hat, and you became bored with them after a while because you saw them all the time. And I just decided one day to wander in, actually inside, and talk to a docent. And so I asked the gentleman in there, You know, I'm curious. You know, there's all these really cool French homes in town, and, you know, there all these events that happen. Where are the French speakers? Are there just no French left here in town? I was like, are there really any French left? You know, and he says, yeah, they're all in the cemetery. You know, I mean, that was his viewpoint on it, which would be kind of interesting because I'm standing in a grocery store, probably not an hour or two after that, standing behind somebody in front of me with the name Bourassa Farms, you know, on the back of a jacket. A lot of the big farmers in our area, a lot of the big farms, a lot of them have jackets with their family crests on them, running around with French family names, you know, but you would even ask them and they could not identify themselves as being French because of the lapse of cultural memory in that specific area. Well, even though there were identifiers of events that we were having, of course, like I say, between the 12th night and the rendezvous, even the fricassees that the families were having fricassees in the area, they're like, well, no, the fricassee, that can't be French because, well, Thomas Jefferson, he did fricassees too, so that's a very American thing to do, you know. And one of the things that I have learned really in the process of over the last 23 years is that our community, through and through, our communities in Southern Illinois, Indiana, and Southeast Missouri are just as American as anybody else's community. In fact, that has really led me to be asked a lot to even do programs for French classes at different universities around the country. And in fact, last year I was even asked to be the keynote speaker at the AATF, Association of Teachers of French, meeting in Chicago, mainly because it has really been sort of a personal, I guess you might say, crusade for me to help people to understand as I began speaking and learning to speak French in my late teens, is that the French language that we have, the culture that we have, isn't a very American culture. In fact, in so many ways, it's even older than the Anglo culture that is here. And in fact, in a very real manner, it's older than the Anglo culture in Southern Indiana, Southern Illinois. For example, as I said, I talk about some of the different cultural identifiers in our area. Just to note, historically, the French first came into our area actually through this region. They actually came down through the Great Lakes, coming down through Michigan. So when they began first coming down, and of course, Michigan was really a beginning, sort of the kickoff point, and you might say to the interland of now what is the United States. Of course, Quebec, the region of the Saguenay Valley, the St. Lawrence Valley were essentially a very safe haven for the French in many ways in the latter part of the 1600s and the early 1700s. And to begin moving down into what is now known as the Illinois country or le pays des Illinois, Le Pays des Illinois, as we call it, or in French, standard French, Le Pays des Illinois, comme ça. As the French began moving down into our area, it was a very dangerous region to be, very different, you know, not having native populations that were as well known to the French moving into our area in the early 1700s, late 1600s. So it would be essentially for these French populations a definitely, you know, they had to find some place that was sort of safe haven to run back to if they could, and that area would be Michigan, actually, early on. So essentially the French came into our area most heavily around 1699 with the very first founding of Cahokia, Illinois, and as well as Kaskaskia, Illinois, both along the Mississippi River. Cahokia is essentially right across from St. Louis, Missouri. And the reason that the French came into our area, there were really kind of two first immediate reasons that the French came. The very first reason is essentially the French government itself was looking for a westward passage. Maybe those of you who have studied in history will know that there was an attempt to find essentially a water route to the Pacific Ocean to get to the East Indies. Essentially, it was for trading reasons The other reason that the French were motivated to come into our region most heavily was because of the Catholic Church, and specifically the Jesuits. They were really at the forefront of leading the French government and the French community of Quebec into our area, because they were looking for souls, is what they were looking for. They were looking for ways to find more converts. You know, they were looking for ways to expand their hold, because those of you that are maybe familiar with the history or conflict within the Catholic Church will know that of the different sects of the Catholic Church, the Jesuits were just one of many, but of course, probably the most militaristic in a lot of ways. In fact, they were on the forefront and were, for lack of a better term, were not afraid. Because it was, to them, it was, you know, a noble thing to die on the frontier if they could for their church. And so many of them were out on the frontier and converting souls. And this became very important, especially for the Catholic Church as they began moving into the Illinois country, because you had sort of a third and fourth tier of French that began moving into the area. And the reason that the French government became backing the exploration into our area was because of two other reasons, and that would have been the fur industry and, secondly, the lead mining industry, or just the mining industry. Now, originally, what brought the French into our area is really very much a, as far as mining goes, is really much a side note or sideshow to history, you might want to say, more than anything else. The reason that they came into our area was because they were looking for gold. Actually, what the French government sent miners, prospectors in our area for was looking for gold. Mainly, how many of you are familiar with Francisco de Soto in any way? Okay, a few of you. Okay, so you know that he was a Spanish explorer. Well, Francisco de Soto had actually been as far north in the 1580s as what is now southern Missouri, and had been into what is now known as the Arcadian Valley in southern Missouri, which is also a part of our own mini Rust Belt in southern Missouri, essentially. And because you have really three major forms of minerals in southern Missouri. You have not only lead, which is sort of the major one, but you also have barite, or lead and galena, actually, and barite, which is sort of a byproduct of the galena, and then most heavily iron mining in Ironton in the Iron Valley, or the Arcadia Valley of southern Missouri. Well, this area was where Francisco de Soto came in, and apparently he never made it back to Spain, but a couple of his men did, and they took samples from that area, and what they took back to Spain, they took back that they thought was gold. Essentially, well, what they arrived with in Spain was iron pyrite. Yeah, fool's gold. I mean, so the term fool's gold, and actually the idea of it, is goes very long back in the history of North America. And, well, here's the thing. The Spanish determined this early on that there was no gold in Missouri. Essentially, they knew that it was a fool's errand to try to find gold in that area, and there was no reason to go there. But the French, on the other hand, they didn't get the word that there wasn't gold. They still understood, even 100 years later, that there was gold in the area along the Great Waters. They knew that there was a large river. They thought that this same river was the same river that would take them to the Pacific Ocean, essentially. So they thought they would get a twofer out of it. They could get themselves to the East Indies, and they could also get gold at the same time. Well, they were wrong on both accounts, and as they often would be many times in trying to find things in the middle part of what is now North America. So, well, essentially, the prospectors went in, found the very simple matter of a fact that, no, there's no gold. But for the country of France, it became a very, very important area, and they saw that its importance very early on, as they found also essentially in 1699, and well, they had already found it 10 years before with a gentleman named Monsieur de La Salle. They had found the mouth of the Mississippi River as it, you know, as it came out into the Gulf of Mexico. So they knew by 1699 and 1700 that essentially they would be able to control the waterways all the way from the mouth of the St. Lawrence River to the mouth of the Mississippi River, and essentially be able to cut off the entire continent at that point and control it, and to sort of pad themselves from the Spanish as well as to pad themselves from the English. And they would be able to control this entire section of the country. And so therefore, they would open themselves up to the mining freely, to the fur trade freely. For the Catholic Church, they got an insurmountable number of souls that they could go after. And for the French themselves, it was the perfect opportunity to do what they did best, which was to not move too far inland, but was to stay on the rivers. And that's essentially what the French would try to do for the most part, is that they would, all the way through the entire of the 1600s, this would play out in the 1700s, the French would essentially make their inhabitation or their villages, all type of colonization would pretty much stay on the rivers. And they wouldn't venture too far inland, because the farther inland they went, the more dangerous it became. And so this was essentially would be the MO of the French moving up and down the rivers. In fact, often there's talk of the, how many of y'all are familiar with the idea of westward expansion? Okay, I'm sure you're probably familiar with that. And the frontier, okay, the idea of the frontier and of, you know, communities and essentially of culture in North America moving west. Well, essentially French culture in North America defies Turner, because you did not have a westward specifically expansion, but you had a cyclical expansion of the French. They did not move west per se. They moved north to south. They moved south to north. They moved somewhat southwest, somewhat northwest. And their culture was one based on rivers and based on the design and the direction of rivers, not based on a just direct, you know, expansion of westward expansion, essentially. So, like I say, you can look at our culture, and I guess I kind of have always had to wear two hats, you might say, as a student of our culture, and a historian of our culture, but also being some guy who just really loves our culture and just someone who really loves our music and our language. And hopefully that little bit of information will help you kind of to understand where the basis for our communities are, why they arrived in our area, and then to move beyond that to understand the cultural imprint of our French. Okay, so we know, as I mentioned before, a lot of the French were coming down from Quebec. Also, they began moving up, essentially, as well, into the middle part of what is now the United States, the Illinois country, in the early 1700s. The French essentially came, founded Cahokia, Kaskaskia, 1699, the very same year. Biloxi, Mississippi, Mobile, Alabama, were also founded by the Iberville brothers, Bienville. And they would begin, also a few years later, the inhabitation and the founding of New Orleans, and the connection would be officially made. By the 1710s, all of New France itself would be split up. The northern end of what is now Canada was actually along Interstate 80, okay? So everything below that would be La Louisiane. Everything below that, La Louisiane. So what you would end up having is a cultural shift that would happen of you had colonization beginning to be forcibly more either in the south or in the north, with our colonies in the middle. But 80% of all the French in North America come from essentially four provinces of France. Now, a lot of people ask me, how do you come up with those numbers? Where do you get that? Thankfully, the Catholic Church. Because the Catholic Church took very, very careful records on where people were born And so we know all the way back in the 1607, essentially, where people were born in France, where they were coming and where they were migrating from in France to Quebec. Then it's just a matter of finding those families in Quebec or then eventually in Louisiana and tracing their route at that point. And so we still know, there again, that over 80% of all the families of North America before 1800 came from essentially four provinces of France. They came from the two main ones were Normandy and Brittany, as well as Picardy to the north, Poitou to the south. Now, culturally, Brittany and Normandy would give us our language and our music for Breton today and La Breton. Of course, there are many people, nearly 100,000 people today, that still speak a language that is not French or English. They speak Gaelic in Brittany today. Okay? Of course, everybody speaks French too, but many of them also have this other language. In Normandy, 400 years ago, a majority of the population of Normandy 400 years ago also spoke Norman French. From the standpoint of being a French student, you might go, well, what's the difference? A big one. I can tell you that. A big, big difference. It's basically Norman French is sort of like an Anglo-French slam is what it is. It's like old English slammed with old French. Not necessarily understandable by modern French standards. So this would be the cultural pool that you had coming over to North America, and thus our language would be different, the language of the French coming here, thus the music, also its influence being Celtic. To the north, Picardy, very important as well. It's a mining area of France. Many of the early miners, especially people like Philippe Renault, who came over and began smelting lead in 1723 in southeast Missouri, would come over. And he would bring with him many miners, school-trained miners for the government of France, who would come over and begin working lead mines in places like Mina Berton, which is Potosi, Missouri, places like La Mina Canon, the Cannon Mines, as well as La Mina Renaudière, which was the Renault Mines. And these would become very important. So every province essentially would have its own importance. Now, some of you may go, well, you've left out one province. Which one did you leave out? Poitou. How is it important? Poitou would become important in the sense that it was very, would give up culturally the different wild card to the French culture coming to North America. In Poitou is where you find the Arcadian Valley. Many of the people from Poitou most heavily moved to Nova Scotia in the early 1600s. They would become the nucleus of the people known as Les Acadiens, who eventually would become known as Cajuns in Louisiana. So they're the wild card of the four provinces, somewhat different than the other groups coming in. Well, I just want to play a few tunes for you. That very first song that I had played was a song called Cadeau de Sel, which actually comes from Brittany. It comes from the Breton coast. I'm going to do another tune here for you. This is a song that sort of gives a little bit of example of some of the Celtic nature of the music in our area. It's a song called Toutes les Dames, which means All the Girls. And this is a song that has been used for years, essentially, as a call song for dances. Now, I'll try to get into a little bit some of the history about that in a minute. Thank you. The Celtic influence is probably one that has still the strongest hold, and as I mentioned, that really some of the traditions that we have in the area, especially our tradition of Carnival, that essentially begins after Christmas and runs through Mardi Gras. Now, a lot of people, when you think about Carnival, you think that Carnival is Mardi Gras. Well, maybe for other cultures that is. But in our area, Carnival is not Mardi Gras. Carnival is a whole season, okay? Just as it was in Brittany and Normandy, Carnival was a whole season that would essentially begin on the Christmas time. Now, in our area, also very different, you might say, compared to maybe New Orleans, maybe compared to Montreal and Quebec, we didn't have the, I'd say, the class, there was not the class stratification that you had in a place like New Orleans, where in New Orleans you had a large city where there was just a really, really large number of very, very rich, high-class individuals. So you had people in like New Orleans, St. Martinville, Quebec, Montreal. You had these major cities where in the early part of the 1700s, even mid-1700s, you had a huge divide, you might say, class-wise. Whereas in our area, really the only place where there was much class divide would actually have been in St. Genevieve, Missouri, and eventually St. Louis. But none of this actually occurred until the latter part of the 1700s in St. Genevieve, after the arrival of Bourbons, many of them trying to escape France at the end of the French and of the Revolution, or the same way with St. Louis, or really until the early part of the 1800s in the case of St. Louis, with the arrival of more Americans, of Anglo-Americans coming in, did you really have that class divide? Because really, the French in our area, really, like I see there again, were a mixture of people working, farmers heavily in our area, or lead miners, priests, probably on the social strata. They were at the top in a lot of ways, because they were even above the military officers, of which there wasn't a huge, massively large military presence in our way. So essentially, you have a very almost egalitarian kind of existence of the French in our area, and an existence that is sort of played out in something that I'm going to talk about, which is an event called La Guillonnée. La Guillonnée. Now, for those that speak French, you might hear parts of that word that you somewhat understand or maybe sound weird anyway, but I'll break it down for you. Gui. Gui is actually Breton Gaelic for mistletoe. Année, year. The mistletoe year. We have an event that kicks off essentially the season of Carnival called La Guillonnée. It's an event that is a Celtic event that is known to be over 2,000 years old. The song itself is known to be somewhere between 700 and 800 years old, roughly. Why do we know this? It's because the Catholic Church made an attempt to actually stamp out the Guillonnée itself. It's kind of like, hey, you know, the Guillonnée was probably always something in Western France that had a certain cultural, you know, part of the community that was something always annual. Well, it's what it is. The Guillonnée itself is an event for charity, is what it is. It's an event in which people blacken their faces. Now, originally, I don't believe so, and some historians don't believe so either, but maybe dressed in costume, in which people went house to house, the rich and the poor. And like I say, in our community, to be rich meant you had three pigs rather than one, maybe in some cases. And to have essentially what it would be is people would go house to house begging for food in a group on New Year's Eve, and they would go begging for the food, not to eat all the food on the spot, not to drink all the drink on the spot, but to actually save this through the season of Carnival, because there were different little markers through the season in which you would have events called bouillons. Bouillons. Okay, a bouillon, B-O-U-I-L-L-O-N, bouillon. Okay, bouillon, soup. essentially soup parties through the entire season of Carnival. Now, what it would be was, like I say, rich, poor, young, old, coming together, going house to house. Now, what happened was, roughly in the 13th century, the Catholic Church, knowing that this was an event for charity, they wanted to make sure that they administered it. Okay? Whatever that means. I'll give you a little exclamation points there, little quotes. So, essentially what happened was they tried to outlaw the Gioni, and then after that it became wildly popular, of course. So, and eventually, after many years, apparently the priests would actually begin trailing the Gioni runs when they would go house to house in the villages. And so what happened were the people started blackening their faces so that the parishioners could not be found out by the priest. Okay. Well, eventually the Catholic Church figured out that it was all they had done was just made it more popular at this point. So they made it legal again. And this time then the priests just went with them, and they were probably the ones that got the most drunk, you know. In fact, at least they still do today anyway. But so essentially the tradition of the Gioni would transfer itself to North America in the 1600s, and the tradition of the Gioni still continues today in southern Illinois and southeast Missouri. People still, every year on New Year's Eve, in the community, everybody comes together in the community to go house to house begging for food. And the idea, of course, they don't keep the food like they used to anymore, you know, with freezers and refrigerators and everything like that. It's not necessary to do that. But there is a song that goes along with that. And the song that goes with it is essentially a begging song, in which you're going to the house and you're begging for, you're asking first for forgiveness when you come in the door, because everybody in the group's, of course, going to come in the door and track mud and dirt and snow all over your house. They're probably going to knock things over because everybody's going to be extremely inebriated. Because one of the things that does happen is they don't drink everything on the spot, but every house you go to, there's lots of adult beverages, okay, out the houses, usually homemade wines, liquors. And it begins usually between 5 and 6 o'clock on New Year's Eve. Goes until midnight. So you have to realize you're going house to house to house, about a house every 40 minutes. You're drinking every house that you go to. All right. I'm often, as I said, since I'm being recorded, I'll get this on record. I have still running the only sober fiddler for years at the end of the night. Somebody's got to do it. So, but the song itself's got anywhere from like 22 to 28 verses to it. When you go house to house, they have a capitan who carries a really big stick, who essentially holds out the first words, because this is a song that they call a chanson à répondre, a response song. He'll yell out the words, the group responds to it, and he carries the big stick to keep everybody in order if people get too drunk. All right, so I'll do a little bit of the tune here for you. I'm not going to do all of it, but otherwise I would probably take the next 20 minutes doing the song. But we'll do it.
Y était de bonne douleur. Pour la dernière jeune année, c'était la gunine du réveil. Si vous voulez nous donner, dites-nous l'aide. Si vous voulez nous donner, dites-nous l'aide. Offre le monde sur le monde, un échiné. Un échiné n'est pas grand-chose à dire quand t'as 26 pieds de long. Un échiné n'est pas grand-chose à dire quand t'as 26 pieds de long. Only verra faire bonne chère, on les verra chauffer les pieds. On les verra belle bonne chère, on les verra chauffer les pieds. Quand on fume même du bois, mais fume à lampe. Quand on fume même du bois, mais fume à lampe. J'ai attendu le coucou chanter et la colombe.
Thank you. Well, let's have quickly mention how I actually learned to play the fiddle and sing these songs. When I showed up essentially in the Missouri Mines area, I had went to school at Southeast Missouri State University, which for me in Southern Illinois is just only a couple hours away. Southern Illinois is a very small area. We can get pretty much everywhere really quick. And we're surrounded essentially in Southern Illinois by four states. So Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, or I say three states, not four states. We are in a four-state region, I guess I should say. And so it's easy to get pretty much everywhere pretty quickly. And when I actually went to school at Southeast Missouri State University, I was more or less complaining to a professor. I had only been there a few days about the fact that, you know, we have such beautiful architecture, you know, French architecture in places like Vincennes and St. Genevieve, Missouri. And incidentally, St. Genevieve, Missouri has the largest number of French Creole homes in all of North America, French style homes. There's over 40 that were built between the 1740s and the early 1820s. In fact, most people, if I ask them that question, where are the largest number of French Creole homes, they say, well, got to be New Orleans. It's got to be Louisiana. Nope, wrong. Actually in Missouri, and all the ones in Louisiana, they either burnt down or they fell down. The climate, if you build on the ground, they disintegrate, bugs, okay? Our area, they built the houses on stone, you know, on stone surroundings, on a stone base, and were able to dig into the ground just like the ancestors from Normandy did, okay, using poteau-en-terre style homes. That was a cultural tradition to build below the frost line with poteau-en-terre, post-in-ground vertical log structures. Okay, very different than Louisiana where the water table is about 6 inches down. You know, you float if you go down. So, you know, I thought it was interesting that we had all these beautiful homes and we had some sort of cultural remnant. But my big thing was, what happened to the language? What happened to the language? This is what this professor mentioned to me. He said, well, it's not gone. It's very much alive in a little area known as itself the old mines. And the old mines are Les Vieilles Mines is actually where I mentioned earlier about Philippe Renault and the arrival of the French in the lead mining area. Well, that area has survived as sort of the maintenance of the culture in every facet, not just a little bit here, a little bit here, but every facet of our French culture has maintained itself living in the old mines area of Southeast Missouri, mainly because of isolation. Isolation would do that because the people in that area, you know, going back to the 1720s, began the lead mining, which eventually also gave way to iron mining and barite mining that people locally call tiff mining. I was joking earlier about the fact that a lot of people, you know, early on were able to do surface mining. Well, what I mean by surface mining is you just can reach down and pick it up off the ground because that's how much of it there is still today. And so lead mining would become very important to the people as much as farming would be a part-time activity, hunting, maybe the fur trade, but lead mining would be something that people would often do actually during the winters. Lead and barite or tiff mining was something that could be done during the winters, and you would only have to work in some cases 2 or 3 days because you were able to pile up enough barite or lead, depending on which company you were working for. And, well, the other 3 or 4 days, you went to bouillon parties, essentially. You barbecued. You made wine. So, therefore, it's been an interesting, you might say historically, an interesting aspect of the French in those areas, because they talk about the French, some that left. Because when you had often the families, too, I have to mention, was also a part of that cultural maintenance, was the fact that many of the families were having 9, 10, 12 kids. But there are also stories of the lack of land and eventually the internal pressure of land and forcing some to leave, having to go to places like St. Charles, Missouri or St. Louis and working in factories in the late 1800s. Now these would become sort of the, these French would sort of become the nucleus of the people that they would call the Frogtown French in places like St. Charles, Missouri, and they would mistakenly think these were the French who were the old cultural French that had founded St. Charles in the 1780s. No. In the 1800s and the early 1900s, these French were culturally miners, essentially. They were still from mining families from the old mines area, taking the French language that had already gone on the wane in St. Charles and St. Louis in the mid-1800s and kept re-infusing the French language and the French culture in these areas because of the large numbers of kids being born and having to leave the area. They would become the reinfusion of French culture in our area every generation as they would leave, because people didn't go in to the mines from outside for the most part, because the French maintained very strong hold on their own property. They did not sell it. They would not sell it to land prospectors coming into the area. They would not sell it to German families moving into the area off the Mississippi River, or especially les Anglais, or les Américains, as they call them. For the longest time, when I went into the area of the old mines area, this professor told me that they still spoke French in the old mines area. And I was suspect of that, but I went to go find out, and eventually got invited to a bouillon party when I was 19 years old. That opened it all up. And over a period of 3 years, I was invited to go to house parties weekly. Even during my summers, I practically lived with some of the families, and this was in 89, 90, 91, 92. At that point, there were still between 500 and 600 people who were fluent, very fluent in the French language. And it was from them, by going to house parties, listening to a lot of the stories, the cultural stories, and songs, that I began to learn to speak French. It was from them, and I learned by ear, because there was only one person in the entire area that could read and write. Because French had been outlawed, essentially, nearly 100 years before being taught in schools. So there are many, many stories that I have. Unfortunately, I don't have time today probably to talk about them, but stories of punishment of kids in the area who tried to speak French at school later on. And eventually, that would lead to where we are today, which is 23 years essentially after I arrived in the area. We have 40 left today who are fluent in the language. And mainly because of the lack of interest and the lack of ability to carry on the language in our area in that way. But I was fortunate in the sense that I became fluent enough in the language that for anybody that meets me or speaks French to me, they like, wow, you speak with a really weird and strange accent. But when I go and hang out with my people in old mines, no, I don't. We all speak that way. But it was sort of that drive going to the house parties that I began to learn to play the fiddle, because there were local people like Charlie Paget, who was an old French Creole fiddler, and actually a guy who had been doing fur trade, had been a lead miner, had also been a tiff miner, had also been a farmer, had also been a mule skinner. One of the things about the people in our area is they've done everything. Nobody would go do just one job. You do many jobs to get by. Another one was a guy named Roy Bouyer, who had been a tiff miner and a barber And from him I learned many songs. In fact, I'll do one for you. This is a tune that a lot of people recognize. This was the first song I ever learned to play on fiddle. I met him at one of the first bouillon parties I went to, because I had taken a fiddle with me that I tried to play in the party, and they actually kicked me out on the porch after about 30 minutes because I played so badly. And Roy felt bad about that, and he invited me to his barber shop. And this is one of the first songs he taught me. Not a French tune, I would come to find out, but actually a very just American tune, something called Red Wing. And but I will tell you before I play it, he told me after teaching me, he said, never go and try to enter a fiddle contest with this tune. And I said, why is that? And he said, because it's French. We play it and it's in French. And I said, but Roy, there's no words to it. He said, I'm telling you, it's don't take it to a fiddle contest. So I did. About 6 to 8 months later, I lost. I went back to him, and I said, Roy, I lost the fiddle contest. He said, did you play Red Wing? I said, yeah. He goes, they didn't speak French. The judges. And you'll see why. Here's the American version. The French version. Is the French version of the song. But essentially after that time, I spent, like I say, about 3 years intensively in the area, really as a student from Southeast Missouri State. And but one of the things, you know, and there as a researcher, more essentially, you know, sort of trying to learn something from them, essentially about who they were, you know, where they were from, why they were here. And eventually what happened is over time I just became one of them in a lot of ways. Still trying to maintain my objectivity over here, but one of the things that I learned really early on is that you got to throw that out the door eventually. And eventually you just accept the people for who they are and you just do what they do and you hope that in some ways you learn a little bit of that and get a little bit of that spark that they've got. Because they've had this spark for a long time that this community has had. Somehow they've been able to figure out how to maintain their cultural identity in a world that essentially does everything that it could possibly do to beat it out of you. And they have found that way to maintain it through their language, through their music. And that's why I've always celebrated them and always enjoy them and enjoy being amongst them. And they consider me one of theirs now and have for a very, very long time. And so a lot of these people are like second mothers to me. A lot of them are like second brothers and fathers. And so so I hope you maybe learned a little bit about it. We know we haven't had a lot of time, but maybe learned a lot about why the French came here, why we're there in Southern Illinois, and maybe a little bit of some of our music. And I'll do one more tune before I open it up for questions. I did want to do maybe one waltz. This was a type of tune that I haven't done yet. Waltz is very important in our culture as well. People work hard in our culture. Like as I mentioned, they're hardworking people. You know, and sometimes, you know, they might maybe only work 3 and 4 days a week, But they'll do 7 days of work in 3 or 4 days. That has always sort of been the MO of most of the people in our area, in the French area. And, well, this is a song that talks about, it's from Vincennes, actually. But it's a song about going and basically doing one of the hardest things was finding food, finding wood in the middle of winter when you couldn't go to the grocery store and go get it. Had to get it on your own. And this is a story about a grandmother complaining at a grandfather that it's the middle of winter and she's hungry, so she wants the grandfather to go find some food. Well, it's not an easy life in the area, nor it never was, and it still isn't necessarily. Maybe satellite TV has made it a little bit easier, I don't know. Or maybe it's made it worse. But anyway, this is a song called Grand-Mère Supplante, which means grandmother complains. And what happens in the story is the grandfather goes out to look for wood, he goes to look for food, and he gets eaten by a wolf trying to find it. But here's sort of the c'est la vie moment with the French in our area, or that joie de vivre, or joie de mourir, depending on how you look at it. The grandmother continues complaining in the song about this. She's still cold, still hungry, really didn't care what happened to the grandfather as long as somebody showed back up with some food. Okay? The lady I learned this from was actually, even though it's from Vincennes, I learned it from a lady named Ida Portell in Potosi, Missouri, originally called Mina Breton, Breton Mines. And she said, Dennis, she said, if you ever go perform this song for anybody, and Miss Ida passed away 17 years ago. She said, if you ever go do this song for anybody, be sure and tell them it was a love story. So I'll do it for you. That's where he got eaten. Oui, qu'il est l'usant manger. Oui, qu'il est l'usant manger. Jig don day. And then now she's dancing. I just want to see if we have any questions. We want to definitely open up for questions.
Well, this is where you use the microphone so that we can get you on tape. So who has a question for Dennis? Hands? Anybody? Oh, up here.
Just really quickly, had you played any violin or fiddle before joining that community?
Maybe for like a month and a half. Or 2 months before I went there. My grandfather, it's a long story, but I was given my great-grandfather's fiddle. And right before that, because I'd played guitar, I'd played drums, I'd played piano once since I was six. I'm actually from a very musical family. On one side of my family, they were actually minstrels all the way back into the 1930s and 40s. One side of my family, on my dad's side, they actually used to play on radio shows around Southern Illinois. And I had different, you know, family members who played. And so when I was little, I had lots of musicians in the family, you know, that played around me. And so music has always been a part of the family. But when I began trying to mess around with the fiddle, I was like, oh, I can do this. This is easy, you know. And I just happened to, at that point, was right when I moved to Missouri. It's just weird. I mean, it just literally happened that I just had been given the fiddle by my grandfather and took it to Missouri, and that's when I got going there. And, you know, and I found out that every time they would have a bouillon, they'd always jam, you know, have music and play music and sing songs. So I took it, figuring I could just, you know, absorb something, like I said. And they literally, I have a picture of that first night that they threw me out on the porch. And they actually joke about it around there. A lot of people have made copies of it since then, of me playing spoons on a box. Because the only way they would let me back in is if I played on the box. No instrument other than that. So, yeah. Any other questions?
Oh, I'll come back to you, okay? Did I see another hand?
You talked a lot about the Catholic Church and
yes.
the influences of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, was there or is there, has there been any influence from the Catholic Church on the fiddling tradition of the region?
You know, I can't really say that. I wouldn't be able to answer that question with any kind of really authority. I really don't know. All I do know is that the Catholic Church has been really at the heart of really maintaining that cultural cohesion in the area, because for years, as far as anybody can remember, they have sponsored dances in the area. They have sponsored parties in which they have very much invited singing, in which they have very much invited music. And in fact, I used to go, was where I met this gentleman, Charlie Paget. He actually passed away in 1994. He was 90 years old when I met him, actually, and played with him for 4 years, met him at the parties. Actually, at the Catholic Church picnics was where I met him. And so they have always been sort of, and not only that, but maintaining songs, I don't necessarily know about specifics like in fiddling, but as far as the ballads, they've been a big part of that, because during the 1940s and 50s and 60s, there was a group called the Parish Workers that was created essentially help the older population. And there's a lot of the older parishioners, and, you know, give them food, send food out them, medical attention. But then essentially what happened was some of the people that were in the parish workers were going out and hanging out with these people, and you had to speak French to be able to care for them, is that they also began learning their stories and songs, too. And so it's also been a way to maintain a lot of the older stories and traditions. And the Catholic Church actually provided for that, you know, in that way. So.
I was curious about the, you mentioned there were only 40, was that the number you said?
It's around 40.
Speakers. What about the music and the stories and the other?
Oh, there's more people that know stories.
So are there young people, and do you see a future for this? I mean,
in a few cases, yeah. In fact, as I mentioned, Charlie Paget, one of the older fiddlers, he has a great-grandson who is 15 now. Of course, never knew his great-grandfather, but I learned to play fiddle from his great-grandfather, and I'm teaching him. I'm teaching the great-grandson how to play, and I'm teaching him specifically the songs of his great-grandfather. There are two other fiddle players that I learned from, and I'm not teaching him theirs. Eventually, if he wants to, I will teach them, but I've been focusing on him with his musical tradition from his family, you know, more specifically. I do see a future for it. The language surviving, who knows? You know, I mean, it's one of those things. I do programs at French classes in the old mines area. I mean, for a living, I go and do it around all over the country, but I go and just do it for gratis. You know, I go in there and just do it for the heck of it, because for them locally, because it's important for me that the local kids learn, you know. And so I do go into the French classes mainly because, and it is a help. I'm not saying a negative, and I'm being sarcastic, but the French teachers that they have only speak Parisian standard French. They don't speak the local French.
And so what I do is I usually go in and I grab maybe one of the elders in the community, if I can talk one of them into going, because they think that the kids are just going to laugh at them, you know, and so they won't go, you know. But so I can get a few of them maybe interested every now and again to go, and we'll go do programs for the kids. And we try to teach them just simple things, you know, to help them understand more of their own cultural language, you know. So who knows, at, you know, there also have been, like, what they have a group called the Guione Singers as well, that has involved kids through the years, in which they have learned to sing some of the songs. And the Catholic Church has also been at the forefront of that locally, is because they have a private Catholic school, and they have the option of teaching the kids the language, you know, teaching songs. And so I think it's never going to be gone totally. You know, it's never going to be gone now, because people enjoy too many things. Like, just for the simplest thing, people in the area love to eat croquignoles. How many of y'all are familiar with a beignet? Okay, you know what a beignet is. Well, a croquignole can kick a beignet's butt any day. It's like that long, that thick, and probably twice as deep fried. So, you know, it's like you got to have a defibrillator when you eat one, you know. But people love them. And, you know, they don't even know, you know, maybe in some cases what cultural baggage they have. But they know that they love them. And so it's something like even the simplest things are going to survive, you know. So.
Now, Dennis, let me ask you a question, because you raised the whole issue of blackface in terms of the tradition.
Yes.
Did blackface come across the ocean as a tradition in the Missouri Mines area?
Yes. It came from France that way.
So, naturally, it's complicated in the United States.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Because of, minstrelry and everything else in terms of blackface. How did the community look at that, especially in terms of being in a multiracial Missouri?
You know, I don't think they think about it at all. You know, to be honest with you, I've never actually mentioned any, you know, or met anybody in the community who has ever thought that it had a racial overtone. You know, they've known where it came from. They can tell you where it comes from, and they know why it's there. And so they never even think for a moment. Now, people coming from the outside and looking in on it, they'll go, what's going on here? You know, but if they don't know the cultural relevance to it, then yeah, it could be a problem. But locally, people know that. And in fact, it's back for so many years. In fact, there are posters and pictures hanging just on the walls of people's houses of Guione runs for 70 years. And, you know, and you'll see groups of men in the 70s and the 80s and the 60s, all with blackface. You know, blackened faces, in some cases masks, maybe not black faces. And so in the community, I will have to say, at one time there was an African Creole component to the community, but it left in the 1800s, essentially. And all it really left as far as the cultural, so there really is no, that cultural diversity within the community isn't there anymore. Okay, between like the black and white populations. But what they did leave was they left Le Bouquet Lapin stories, Brer Rabbit stories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We have the French version that was brought over from West Africa called Bouquet Lapin. When Bouquet is a hyena. Yeah. And but it's known as, in the Brer Rabbit stories, becomes what? A fox. Okay, but in the original French, the Brer Rabbit stories were actually translated from French. But we have the original French versions of those stories. So that is one cultural, actually say, remnant of actually the African population of our area that was there. So
now I'm going to take one last question up here. And when I'm on my way up, I'm going to ask Dennis, first of all, did you bring CDs for sale by chance?
You know, they're out in the car.
They're out in the car. Okay, but those will be available tonight.
I can call my buddy and see if he could bring them up. If anybody's interested,
any hands uninterested in CDs, okay, we'll call then.
Okay. I'll call him.
But I'm about to hand it over. Let me just remind you to sign in if you haven't signed in already, to come back. And then I'm going to ask if Dennis, if possible, after answering this question, would play one more for
before we go.
Here we go.
Thank you for answering again my question
in advance.
But, so I'm wondering if there was a gender when you were learning this fiddle tradition, and maybe historically before that, if there was a gender tradition between did women play this music?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And like, what were their roles in the music?
Well, mainly singers. As far as instrumentalists, guitar, often. I've only met one female fiddler in the area. Mostly it was the guys because, there again, 13, 14 children in some cases, 8, 9, and oftentimes it was the guys, you know, they even looked upon the dances as a money-making thing, you know, and it was not necessarily, you know, they had house dances that people would go play. There really weren't bars in the area until the 40s or 50s, and so the men would go out and play the dances, women would stay home, take for the care of the kids, you know, and so it's been a very old-style tradition, you know, in that area, but here's what happened, though. The men, more than the women, held on to the fiddle tradition, but the women were the ones who held on to the songs, the actual ballads. And so they would teach the ballads to the kids because often the men were out working, you know, they were gone. So it often was up to the women, and so they actually really are the crux of the maintenance of the language and the songs. If it had not been for their role, it wouldn't have survived at all. Because I learned to speak French primarily from women. I learned to sing songs primarily from women. I learned from Velma Schaefer. I learned from Annie Paget. I learned from Ida Portell. I learned from Marguerite Portell-Polit. I've learned from Natalie Villmer. I can only mention two men, actually, that I learned any number of songs from. Most of the songs that I know I learned from women because they all passed them down and they would sing them with the kids. Whereas the men knew the songs but never sang them with the kids, you know. And so the women's role, even if they weren't quote unquote playing an instrument, was in many ways way more important than that of what the man's role was, you know, in the maintenance of so many things, because they held the stories. At home, they held the songs, which basically, in a nutshell, encapsulated the language, too, which is why most of the people who still speak French that are left are women in the area. Out of those roughly 40, only about 7 of them are men. You know, most of them are women that speak the language. And so that's why they actually kind of laugh about me. They think I'm silly because, you know, here I am, a guy coming in, they're like, me hanging out with the women all the time, you know, when I would go, you know, I would go to like knitting parties, you know? Yeah, of course. I mean, that's where they were meeting. So I would go and they were hanging out knitting and telling stories. And I would sit 3 or 4 hours with them and just absorb the stories, maybe tape them or whatever, you know, and they would laugh about this college student showing up, you know, the guy hanging out with all the women, you know, and the old women in the area, you know, so I didn't care. You know, I learned to speak French. So, you know, and so, yeah, so I mean, sort of that way, they're, like I say, in some cases, some of them are instrumentalists, but more than anything, they were the ballad keepers, you know, in the area. Yeah. Okay, I'll do one more tune. In fact, I'll do one of those ballads. I'll do another one. Do another one from Annie Paget. I'll just do a few lines of it. This is a song called, it's called La Belle Blondine is the name of it. It's actually our local version of Lizzie Borden. You might say, woman, she kills her dad, buries him under the porch. And but anyway, I learned this one from Annie. Annie passed away about 10 years ago, Annie Paget. She was a great singer. C'est la belle blondine, Marlorelle Lona. C'est la belle blondine qui fait une chanson. Chanson, quand la chanson commence, malade l'honneur, quand la chanson commence, son père a tué, then she just killed him. time. Thank you.
So again, you've got the three upcoming brown bags, couple across the street, come back here April 19th for the thing about the 1913-14 copper strike. Thank you again to Dennis. And if any of you are interested in asking further questions, come on up. Or if you're interested in CDs, I think he's dialing the phone even as we speak.
I am.
So thank you so much for coming.